So that last panelist that you saw, Ana Lamaro, I was at her funeral yesterday. So it was a few other people present in the audience who was at her funeral. So as she said, there's no fifth stage to her cancer or any other cancer. There's four stages that the doctors use, and she came to the end of that fourth stage. And that was on the 2nd, I think, of January. She died. So, but before that, she was able to participate in this dialogue on euthanasia, which is assisted suicide. And so the topic being euthanasia and suicide. Commonly for Buddhists, we look at the five precepts, and the very first precept that was chanted this morning, so that's Panatipata, Veramini Sikkhapadang Samadhiyami. So Panatipata, not to to take life. That's what that means. And commonly for a Buddhist, it will be interpreted as your life, anybody else's life. So suicide typically is taught as being breach of the first precept, the first of the five precepts. That's very common. Traditionally, that's what monks will tell you. I will say most monks will tell you this, traditionally. And there's a reason for that. And I think it comes down to maybe two factors. One, let's keep it simple. Let's not think about it too much. Don't think about the topic too much. So a lot of monks will probably be a bit lazy about this. Killing is killing, so it's wrong and you'll go to hell. You'll probably hear that many times, but you'll also hear that from a Christian pastor as well, right? It doesn't require much nuance if it's just a simple rule and you interpret it purely in black and white terms. The second factor is, for a monk, we have a rule in our monastic vinaya. Vinaya means our monastic rules. So we have a rule that actually stipulates that a monk is not to speak in praise of death or in praise of killing, nor to seek out a method for killing. Even so far as to encourage a woman, have an abortion. If she has one, if she has an abortion based upon our advice or our encouragement, we're finished as a monk. Yeah. And so a lot of monks on that basis will be scared out of their wits. Anybody says to me, oh, Bhante, I've got a relative on life support. La 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 la, I'm not listening, la la la. But people don't go to you for la la la. They need help. So when they come to a monk, but unfortunately most monks will default to that simply because they don't want to stop being monks. So it's a fear. But it's a fear based on misunderstanding of the rule or not understanding it well enough. So you need to have in your mind the idea of that person dying and being killed. For the monk, that thought needs to be present. It's a factor of the rule with the intention or the thought of that may that person die. You know, most monks I know aren't really interested in people being killed or dying. It's quite rare to find a monk who is like that, although at the time of the Buddha it happened, which is why we got the rule for our monks. So it's important to keep this in the back of your mind. When you ask the advice of a monk, don't expect him to say, yep, turn the machine off on Tuesday afternoon. Kill them good. I mean, they're not going to say that. If you are for a black and white answer, you're probably not going to get it from a Buddhist monk. If you want assistance with making the decision, then you can get some assistance in terms of being in knowledge about the decision, yes. But don't expect a black and white answer, because quite frankly, most of us are not going to give you, yeah, do it, or no, don't, because it isn't black and white. You have to feel these kinds of things out. Emotions are kind of very high, run very high when we talk about issues of life and death. So it's important that you're not making a decision based on high emotional states, which is very hard to do when we're talking about the death or the impending death of a loved one, or continuing the life support for that person. One of the tricks when the Buddha establishes a lot of these rules was in a time when there was no such thing as electricity, let alone life support. Life support was getting a sponge, putting it in a bowl of water and dripping it onto the lips so the person doesn't dehydrate to death straight away. That was life support back then, right? Forget about machines that go bing. We didn't have it back then. So now we're looking at a situation where we have artificially And this is a key word. We are artificially prolonging life. If you had let it run its course, most people, you know, well, there won't be a three-month coma, right? It just won't happen. Like now, you can have people who are in comas for years, but that's because they're given all sorts of IV drips and blah, blah, blah. Anybody else goes into a coma, you usually got less than 2 weeks to survive, probably 3 or 4 days, before you dehydrate. Now we've got IV, we've got machines that keep your heart going and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's all wonderful, but is this what the Buddha's actually talking about 2,600 years ago? The extension of life. The Buddha, I'm not familiar in any sutta where the Buddha is encouraging people to live as long as they possibly can. I've yet to read such a sutta. If you know of one, great, let me know. But from my understanding, from my memory, I cannot recall any sutta where the Buddha is saying, live as long as you can. This is the whole ideal of the holy life. He doesn't say that. He says to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, but he doesn't talk about, you know, extending your life as much as you possibly can. When we look at the rules that we have currently, or the laws or legislation we have in any country, they are largely based upon the predominant religion of that land. So in Australia, this is predominantly a Christian country. Okay, the Judaic religions, or the Abrahamic religions, that is anything based on the Old Testament, Judaism, Islam and Christianity. This forms the majority of the religious practice within Australia. But we should recognize that the rules of this land is governed largely by the religion. If we go back to England, where a lot of the convicts, etc., the first settlers, apart from the Aborigines, who are thankfully got nothing to do with the convict past, apart from being the victims of it. If we go back to where the first settlers come from, we will go back to England mostly. And we will then see what kind of legal system do they have? Well, that's what we have, the Westminster system, right? And what is that based on? If we track it back far enough through the centuries, we will find that there's this lovely little relationship between the church and the state. And so when that happens, of course, rules will be formulated to support that religion. If you go to the Middle East, it's no different. Don't expect a lot of Christian rules in the Middle East or Buddhist rules. You'll get rules based upon the belief of Muhammad, his practices, etc., and the interpretations of the Quran, more so than you will on the New Testament, which might be more of a factor for the Christian countries in England, as an example of France or Italy. So what we have now inherited in Australia are laws based upon Christian ideologies, and that is, life is sacred. A lot of Buddhists probably would agree with this. I don't particularly see life as sacred. I don't think the Buddha actually says life is sacred, like it's a holy thing. He says human birth is rare, yes, but it doesn't have this little Holy Spirit flame on top of your head, like it's something special, so holy, it comes from God. We don't have that kind of thinking. So when you kind of look at that background or that framework of how these laws are framed, it's about original sin. If you kill yourself, then you go straight to hell because you're tainted with original sin. So the law is framed upon suicide. Oh, that's a wrong thing. You'll go straight to hell. How does the law frame it? Well, we think the same way with the law as well. You shouldn't kill yourself. That's a bad thing to do. And that thinking is brought across into the hospitals. If you think about it, it's not logical. It's not rational. Why should a country or a state have the right to tell you what to do with your life if it's not affecting somebody else? Most of our laws are about not hurting other people or bothering them or inconveniencing them. You know, you can't have a loud party at midnight in Australia because there's noise laws, because people around you will be affected by that. But the decision that you make about your own life, how does that anybody else's business? You might argue it's, well, you've got a family. Well, okay, close friends and family might be affected by this. Outside of that, probably healthcare professionals. I think if ambulance drivers turn up, oh, what a mess. This person's killed themselves with a shotgun. They've got no other option, so they're going to use a shotgun today, or they're going to hang themselves. So healthcare professionals are in the direct firing line of these laws. In one way or another, doctors will be involved in this as well. Nurses will be involved. Paramedics will be involved. Because of a law and the way it's phrased, because of a religious belief. If we have truly separation from church and state, you going into hospital to get an x-ray should be no different from your decision whether to die or to live. Why should it? It's not a spiritual thing. Getting an x-ray is not a spiritual thing. You don't ask God for permission for an x-ray. You're not seeking the Buddha's assistance when you're getting an MRI done. So then why do we apply a different kind of thinking when it comes to the ending of our lives? It actually doesn't make sense when we think about it in this way. We can only understand these problems arise out of philosophies and religious views, some of which may not actually be correct. Yeah. So it's very common for a monk to say, you'll breach the five precepts by breaching that first precept by committing suicide or assisting somebody else to commit suicide. You're breaking the first precept. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to raise from the texts actually what happened at the time of the Buddha in regards to three monks who killed themselves. Lord forbid. And worse, they were arahants. Arahants, fully enlightened beings who killed themselves. The first reference, I would have liked to put it up on the screen, not possible, but you can look it up if you want to. When you go home, you can check it out. So the first one is from the Samyutta Nikaya, sutta number 23.3. This is called Gaudika. Interestingly enough, it's got the spelling G-O-D. H-I-K-A, Gaudika, not God, hiker. Like, hike out of here, God, you're not required for this. So here we go. I'm just going to read a fragment of this, not the whole thing, so you at least get the drift. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Buddha was dwelling at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Now, on that occasion, the venerable Gaudika was dwelling on the black rock on the Isagili slope. Then, while the venerable Gaudika was dwelling diligent, ardent, and resolute, he reached temporary liberation of mind, but he fell away from that temporary liberation of mind. A second time, whilst the venerable Gaudika was dwelling there, he reached temporary liberation of mind, but he fell away from that. A third, a fourth time, a fifth, a sixth. Whilst the venerable Gaudika was dwelling diligent, ardent, and resolute, he reached temporary liberation of mind, but he fell away from that temporary liberation of mind. A seventh time, while the venerable Gaudika was dwelling diligent, ardent, resolute, he reached temporary liberation of mind. Then it occurred to the venerable Gaudika, six times already I have fallen away from temporary liberation of mind. Let me use the knife. Then Mara, the evil one, having known with his own mind the reflection in the venerable Gaudika's mind, approached the Buddha and addressed him with these verses. O great hero, great in wisdom, blazing forth with power and glory, I worship your feet, one with vision, who has overcome all enmity and fear. O great hero who has vanquished death, your disciple is longing for death. He intends to take his own life. Restrain him from this, O luminous one. How, O blessed one, can your disciple, one delighting in the teaching, a trainee seeking his mind's ideal, take his own life, O widely famed? Now, on that occasion, the venerable Gaudika had just used the knife. Using the knife, I'm going into commentary now. Using a knife means he slit his throat. On in this particular sutta, he says he's when the monks arrived there to see his body, his shoulder is turned. The term shoulder is turned is commonly used to indicate death posture. Now, in this particular sutta, the commentary will try to have you believe, this is commentary, not the actual sutta, the commentary will have you believe he was not an arahant at that time, and that he was just a non-returner or something, and he attained arahantship upon the death as he was dying. And the commentaries have this ability and a tendency to smooth things over, because this is a little bit awkward. How does an Aryan, even a stream enter or above, how does an Aryan break the five precepts? Commonly you will hear people say, it's impossible for an Aryan to break the five precepts. I've yet to see that in the suttas. But what I have seen, impossible for a stream enterer and beyond to do, there are five factors. What five? It's impossible for them to kill their father. It's impossible for them to kill their mother. It's impossible for them to kill the Buddha, or well, to draw the blood of the Buddha with the intention, right? It's impossible for them to kill an Arahant, and it's impossible for them to commit a schism within the Sangha, a split within the Sangha. It says, these are the five things which are impossible. So if that's impossible, outside of that is? Possible. Uh-oh. Well, your sisters and brothers aren't there, are they? Pet dog? Can kill those? Possible. It's not on the list of the impossible. It's not likely an Aryan wants to kill something. It might be accidental. So here the actual verse of Mara is something which is injected into the sutta after the death of the Buddha. It's commentary. All the poetic stuff, it's commentary, right? It's not the direct speech of the Buddha. So here the commentators are trying to fudge it a little, make it look reasonable. Oh, he can't be an Arahant's killing themselves. Oh, no, that doesn't work. Bad public relations. Let's have it as he's a trainee. Now, when the Buddha uses the term trainee, it means an Aryan who has not attained Arahantship. They've inserted the word trainee into the poetry, not the other stuff, which would then make it the Buddha's speech. At least they're conscientious to that level not to mess around with the direct words of the Buddha. They probably wouldn't like the karma of doing that. That is editing the Buddha's speech to make it sound something that it wasn't. But by putting this poetry in, they've certainly given it a flavour. A flavour which says it's impossible for an Arahant to kill themselves. But unfortunately, this is not the only example of an Arahant killing themselves. The next one I'll bring up. By the way, the Buddha says he died blamelessly because he was an Arahant. He died blamelessly, right? And the Buddha does say in another sutta that those who pick up another life after this life, they are blameworthy. So if you kill yourself and you have another birth, it's called blameworthy. So we'll go on to the next one. The next one is in the Majjhima Nikaya, so this is a different collection, just in case you thought there was a run of three in the same place. It's not. So this is the middle length discourses of the Buddha. This is the Chano Wada Sutta, number 144 of the Majjhima Nikaya, Chano Wada, advice to Chana. So I'm just going to read out, he was sick. This monk was sick. He's gravely ill. He was afflicted. Venerable Sariputta comes to visit him. He says, friend Sariputta, I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent. I shall use the knife, friend Sariputta. I have no desire to live. Uh-oh. So Venerable Sariputta says, let the Venerable Chana not use the knife. Let the Venerable Chana live. So here comes the palliative care statement. We want the Venerable Chana to live. If he lacks suitable food, I will go in search of suitable food for him. If he lacks suitable medicine, I will go in search of suitable medicine for him. If he lacks a proper attendant, I will attend on him. Let the Venerable Chana not use the knife. Let the Venerable Chana live. We want the Venerable Chana to live. That's your palliative care statement, right? What you're talking about there, medicines, attending to the sick, blah, 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 as much as they're capable of doing back in the time of the Buddha. So Chana's response, friend Sariputta, it is not that I have no suitable food and medicine or a proper attendant, but rather, friend Sariputta, the teacher has long been worshipped by me with love, not without love, for it is proper for the disciple to worship the teacher with love, not without love. Friend Sariputta, remember this, the Bhikkhu Chana will use the knife blamelessly. By saying that, he is saying he is an Arahant. Remember what I said before, those who pick up another birth are blameworthy. And that includes once returners and non-returners. That's blameworthy if you have another birth, which they will have. But here he is saying, by that statement, he's an Arahant. Oh dear. another awkward sutta. Unfortunately, the commentators can't redact everything to be consistent. So here later on it says, then when the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahachunda had advised the Venerable Chana, because they actually went through to discuss asking him questions on Dhamma to test his Dhamma understanding. Is he really enlightened? What fears or apprehensions does he have? And he doesn't have any. So then soon after they had left, they had gone, the Venerable Chana used the knife. Knives must have been very popular back then. Probably one of the few things which are accessible for a monk. So then the Venerable Sariputta went to the Buddha and he said, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Chana has used the knife. What is his destination? What is his future course? Sariputta, didn't the Bhikkhu Chana declare to you his blamelessness? So that must mean he's an arahant. Venerable Sir, there is a Vajjian city called Pubajira. There the Venerable Chana had friendly families, intimate families, approachable families as his supporters. Indeed, Sariputta, the Bhikkhu Chana had friendly families, intimate families, approachable families as his supporters. But I do not say that to this extent he was blameworthy. Sariputta, when one lays down this body and takes up a new body, then I say one is blameworthy. This did not happen in the case of the Bhikkhu Chana. The Bhikkhu Chana used the knife blamelessly. This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Sariputta was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Oh dear, that's a second one. Suicide in the suttas. And suicide by those who are finished in terms of enlightenment. They've got no more work to do in terms of enlightenment. Now the next one, because some people are skeptics. It's once only. It's not a very strong case. Okay, here's number three. It's called the Vakali Sutta, it's Vakali, V-A-K-K-A-L-I, from the Samyutta Nikaya, number 87.5. Similar kind of story again. So this bhikkhu says, Venerable Sir, I am not bearing up, I am not getting better. Strong, painful feelings are increasing in me, not subsiding, and their increase, not their subsiding, is to be discerned. Please keep in mind, arahants still have physical pain, right? Not the emotional pain, but they have physical pain. So even they would probably like to palliate themselves at a minimum because it's just pain. There's nothing noble in pain. And the Buddha says this in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Hino gamu potu janiko anario natta samhito. So talking about these painful austerities which are neither noble or beneficial, right? Painful austerities, painful practices inflicted upon oneself deliberately because there was an idea that that was going to be good for reducing bad karma, which is not what the Buddha teaches. Okay, same thing again. The bhikkhu gets to that point. He's questioned by the other monks about, do you have any doubt about perception as impermanent or permanent, intention as impermanent or permanent? He says, okay, it's fine. Then not long after the bhikkhus had left, the Venerable Vakali used the knife. Oh dear, another one. Now towards the end, Mara is trying to find the consciousness of this monk, and the Buddha sees this swirling vortex running north, south, east, west. And so the Buddha says, that bhikkhus is Mara, the evil one, searching for the consciousness of the clansman Vakali, wondering where now has the consciousness of the clansman Vakali been established? However, bhikkhus, with consciousness unestablished, the clansman Vakali has attained final nibbana. It's not sounding good, is it really? It's not very convenient for the five precepts idea. Arahants are incapable of breaching the five precepts. Incapable of it, because it's basic sila. We're not talking something profound with the five precepts. This is really basic, guys. When you look at the Vinaya, there's thousands of rules. Arahants will maintain that to the best of their knowledge, if they know of them. Some arahants may not. Some monks may not know all of the lesser and the minor rules, perhaps. But what they do know, they follow, and they don't breach to the best of their abilities, right? But here, the five precepts, this is something which is kind of basic, fundamental to the holy life. You can't kill another human being when you're an arahant. You have no anger and you have no greed and you don't have any delusion. How is it possible to do a breach of the five precepts? It's not possible, right? So we're not talking about stream enterers now, we're talking about arahants. We've made a switch because they're freed from greed, hatred and delusion. Why do I mention this? It challenges your concept of the five precepts in terms of precept number one, that is killing, as being only about, not just about myself and another. Maybe this is going to be confined just to killing other human beings, the taking of life or other animals, not one's own life. We might need to challenge that particular precept. Here, there are three instances where arahants kill themselves, right? And as I've just said, it's not possible for the arahant to breach the five precepts, which would imply that the first precept is not about yourself, it's about other beings, not to take the life of other beings. Am I sitting here saying, go to your nearest hospital and turn off all the life supports for people in comas? No, I'm not saying that. Am I saying that you shouldn't undertake palliative care options? No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that we need to challenge sometimes our preconceptions when faced with evidence which contradicts those presumptions. And I'm also speaking of my friends in the holy life as well who would persist with the idea any breach of the five precepts, and the first one being taking of life, necessarily involves suicide. It's very easy to say that because, well, pretty much all the other religions are saying it, but it doesn't make it dumber just because others are saying it. We have to look deeply into it. So I raise these three suttas for you to investigate for yourself, for you to contemplate for yourself. When you're faced with that situation, and it's likely there will be a few of you in this room who will have to face this situation, especially those who are in the medical fraternity. I don't think doctors are murderers. Because if you took the five precept line, the first precept, well, any doctor that turns off a life support is a murderer and they're breaching the five precepts. Well, congratulations. You won't have any Buddhist doctors if that's the case. They'd all have to go into another religion or no religion. But this is not the case. We have evidence in the suttas to suggest that this is a little bit more nuanced than what we first think and usually fed in terms of the interpretation of the first precept. I would encourage further investigation into this and let your heart guide you. Be very careful though, with the motivation and intention. It can be two different things. When you're talking about a life support machine, your motivation might be compassion. Oh, it's so much suffering for that person, 3 months in coma. But your intention, nevertheless, is to turn it off and to stop their life support, which will bring about their death. So the motivation can be compassion, but your motivation might be corrupt. You find it difficult and challenging to see the person in that situation. Doesn't mean that that person is suffering as much as you. How do you know how they're suffering? Especially if they can't talk. If they can talk, it's different. That's where the voluntary assisted dying comes in, euthanasia. But if the person's quiet, they can't communicate, this is very challenging. So I encourage, just like in the panel there, I encourage you to talk to your loved ones. Have an advanced healthcare directive or whatever they call it, even though it's not legally binding. But at least it indicates to whoever reads it what your wishes are at the time of your writing it. I've told my sister how I feel about this thing, this particular topic, and I've given her clear instructions. I've emailed her so she knows what I want. Because it'll come down to a family member, right? It's not going to come down to you guys to make a decision. It'll come down to family members. That's how the system works, right? And doctors and nurses are usually fearful of being sued. So it's going to go back to a family decision so they can shift the blame or the decision to somebody else. But we have to be careful about that. Keep in mind, where does this law come from? It comes from a philosophy and ideology of another religion. It's not dhamma-centric. Okay, it's centered on another religious belief system. So keep that in mind. Also keep in mind what you just heard here in these three excerpts from the suttas about how fully enlightened ones killed themselves. They didn't ask for others to kill them. It's not a euthanasia case, but they killed themselves, suicide. A complex topic. I could spend the whole day on this topic. but we don't have a whole day. So I offer that as something for you to think about, and I open up for any questions if there are questions. Yep. Do you want to go?
But I'm projected because just now when you said that these are, I think it's just the presentation of the words. You said that it's impossible to kill, and therefore hence, taking the negative, you conject that it's possible to kill this. But I would say there's always that middle ground where there's not spoken.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just commenting, I think on presentation, when you make the conjecture that where it states that it's impossible to kill this, the alternative means that it's possible to kill this.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, is that as the center where it's not spoken?
Well, in the time of the Buddha would stay silent when he consented. So in the absence, if you want to go with that line, if you go with the line of, if this is impossible and the rest is silent, well then it's consent.
Is it consent or he just doesn't say?
He's not actually consenting to it. I'm not going to go that far. I'm not saying the Buddha's going, well, you know, arahants should go off and, you know, or stream enterers should go off and go start killing people. That's going too far. But what I said was, if it's not in the list of the impossible, logically, it has
logically.
To be...
I understand where you're going logically.
Logically, yeah.
I'm just taking that conjecture where something is positive and you turn it around, say, it's negative, there could be a grey area somewhere in the middle. I'm just... I'm just playing with words.
Sure. Yeah.
The other aspect of it, I think I'd just like to make comments, is the three suttas that you mentioned.
Yep.
It talks about arahants.
Mm.
Is there a sutta which talks about non-arahants and the implication?
I've seen one other one, but unfortunately this is in the Therigatha, and it is a monk again. And he was frustrated practicing, I think, something like 20 years as a monk and had not becoming enlightened or something. But then he started to think, well, I might as well kill myself, right? And he goes through that. There's also a nun who does the same thing, gets right to the point, noose around the neck, just about to kick away the stool or whatever, and then eureka, or in this case, nibbana, right? So she became an arahant, yeah, with that. Probably the stress of the situation probably makes you think a bit more clearly sometimes. Just like in a car accident, everything seems to slow right down. Although it's happening very quickly, it's almost as if things are moving in slow motion. You pick up all your senses because you're not distracted by what you're going to watch, you know, on TV tonight. When you're in that moment of possibly dying, it's amazing how all the dross just gets cut away from your thinking process. And so it seems as if time is slowing down. It's not slowing down at all. It's just that your awareness, your sati, is stronger at that time. It's heightened because of the seriousness of your situation, right? You're not going to off-put it to, you know, some next week I'll think about it. Nah, it's now, and it's on, and it's deadly. And so both for that monk and for that nun, they became arahants. And this is because of the frustration with their practice. I'm not saying go out, become a monk, become frustrated, and then you become an arahant, okay? That's not what I'm saying. And I'm not suggesting you go home and try suicide. There aren't, I can't recall any cases of lay people committing suicide.
And the Buddha talking about the implication of a non-arahant.
Mm. Well, he says one who picks up another life is blameworthy, so... The implication is direct. It's not an implication.
you're gonna have that coming up in the karma.
It will. But the Buddha also says intention is karma. Why are you killing yourself? Somebody who's suffering from depression, for example, they're killing themselves not because of a life, like a terminal life disease or something, life-ending disease. It's a bit of a different situation. It is suffering, yes. Depression is suffering. Anxiety is suffering. Not getting what you want is also suffering. Okay, separation from those who you love is suffering. But is it going to kill you? It's painful, emotionally painful, but will it actually kill you, the emotional pain? Probably not. Unless, I mean, of course, unless you take that step in suicide, right? But the thing is that kind of thinking, the intention behind dying or killing yourself with depression or emotional suffering, that doesn't stop simply because the body stops. And that's why I think the Buddha is saying here, this is blameworthy. Because that emotional suffering is not going to stop just because you put an end to this body. You think, oh, now I'm free. No, it's going to like, oh, I shouldn't kill myself. My life was awful. Everything's awful. Jeez, it's awful. It's still awful. Then you're born as a ghost or you go into the hell realm. It's still awful, right? Because it's not the body which is creating the problem. It's the mind. For those bhikkhus here who killed themselves, they were suffering from bodily problems. Right? It's a different scenario. The suffering that arahants go through from bodily pain, they get nothing from it. There's nothing for them to get from a bodily suffering. Feeding it. Why feed this carcass anything when you're an arahant?
Yeah,
it's just, it's pointless.
An example of a sutta where the person is not arahant, I guess that makes it a lot clearer from, you know, what they can.
Sure. Yeah, but the intention's the important part. For the arahants, they only hang around to teach Dhamma. What else are they hanging around for? To get a job and pay rent? For what? They don't raise families. They don't care about going overseas holidays. They're finished with book readings and internet. Oh, gee, YouTube's interesting. They're finished with all of that stuff. They're done with it. There's no interest whatsoever in those things. So just maintaining a body so that it can be a constant source of suffering, for what purpose? But that's arahants. When you step away from that, it changes the context. All right? So this is, it does require some thinking. Yeah.
Assuming that there are no arahants here.
Assuming.
I mean, for us, I mean, being born as human being is rare. And I'm not promoting living forever. But if live a bit longer, if your mind is clear, there's opportunity for it to develop further.
Sure. Yeah. If you've got the opportunity to live to 100 years of age and you're not in great suffering and pain to the extent it's hard for you to concentrate, of course you're going to have opportunities every day for making a breakthrough. There is that opportunity. There is a chance there. There's no chance when you die and you go to another realm like the hell realm or ghost realm. You're not going to get enlightened in the ghost realm and the hell realms and the animal realm, right? The brain or the mind is, or both, are insufficient for the purpose of developing insight in those realms. Deva realm and human realm, yes, but not the lower realms. There's too much suffering, or the brain doesn't assist you. It's not complicated enough to assist you with complex ideas like tomorrow. Animals don't think of tomorrow like we do, right? They only think of the now, hungry, now, eat, right? Very basic kind of thinking, based upon greed, hatred, and delusion still. But their brains are not complicated enough to process the more complex philosophical ideals of existential suffering, like a human can, or like a deva can. Yep.
Recently, Bubbles has passed away.
Oh, okay. Bubbles is a family pet. Yep.
Yeah, so we treat her like a sister, but we actually had to euthanize her. Because she lost control of her hind legs, and she couldn't walk really. So, it happened when I was over here, so I could only see her through Skype.
Oh.
So, when we were actually deciding what to do, I messaged the family chat, and before I left from Singapore, I sat down with her, like what Ajahn Brahm recommends. And I asked her, do you think it's time to go? So she gave me her answer. And then
was it an email or?
Just by feeling.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Is that actually the right way to decide whether or not to euthanize a dog? Because we could tell that she was in a lot of pain.
How? How could you tell if she was in a lot of pain?
Through her body actions. Like she would be very, she would give a very frustrated sort of action, she won't be able to walk, and because she used to have previous ailments also, but she will always fight back, and we will bring her to the park and she's always better after that, or bring her to the vet, IV drip and all that. So we've been doing that for a couple of years already. So then now it's like, it feels like she has enough.
Did she give up on eating, or she lost her appetite?
She gave up on eating or something.
Yeah, that's usually one of the signs. The person, even in humans, it's the same. You go to palliative care and at hospitals, when the patient's kind of refusing food, it's like, and they're doing that for a few days, you know, not likely to keep going on with this. Yeah, happened to my grandfather as well. Same thing, he broke his hip in hospital. Went in for something else, broke his hip in hospital, and that was enough for him. And so he gave up. I could see in his eyes, he just wasn't interested anymore. Lost the will to keep going. So in the same kind of situation, with it's a loved one, or be it a pet or another human being, you know, it's best obviously to ask that person, if it's a person. If it's an animal, still ask. But you're trying to intuit, right? Because obviously they're not going to talk to you in, you know, a human language. They're not going to send you an email or an SMS. But you're going to be sitting there and you're going to be trying to look for the response on the heart level, right? This is where intuition will be kicking in. But you check it over a period of time. Don't just like one day, oh, no, it's, and then, right? That's it, get out. Not like that.
So intuition, but over a period of time.
Yeah. If it doesn't look, if it looks consistently bad, then you might have to think about what's the most compassionate thing. You can try medicines. It sounds like your family has tried medicines and IV drips. And I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who won't even go to the extent of an IV drip for a dog, okay? But you've gone through all those processes. She bounced back, which is great. It looks like she's not bouncing back. Then it's probably heading in one direction. And I'm not talking about a band.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you've done something compassionate and reasonable, right? Not just going gun trigger happy, boom, straight away when there's the slightest discomfort or problem. You've given it a go. Just imagine if it's another person, same deal. You know, granddad, oh, I've got a sore hip, oh, sorry. Time, half a year or a couple of weeks or whatever. It takes time to look at these cases. But you lead with the heart, compassion. Yeah.
How do you feel about it now?
I feel like she... I mean, I don't know what's the religion. I feel a lot better for her because I know she's always been in pain.
You told her no.
Yeah. If you feel guilt, there's a problem. It's kind of baked, it's put into you so strongly. Suicide is hell, you'll go to hell. Of course, it's easy for guilt to come up when you've had that kind of training. So although we might laugh about it, it is a form of brainwashing and it can have a very deep impact on your heart. I was raised as a Catholic and took a couple of years after leaving the Catholic faith for that guilt thing to go away, because it's kind of pushed into you as a child, day after day, year after year, right? So you have to decondition yourself.
So yeah. After the event itself, you feel that you do not have guilt and you actually feel happiness for that being itself?
It's either one of two things. It's either compassion or delusion. But you're hoping it's compassion. But the thing is, when others hear of the story, they will probably say it's compassion, right? That'll give you a better indicator. But they need to be good friends, spiritual friends, not, you know, vets who are making money from the process. Yes, euthanasia is good at $58 an injection. It's like, okay.
I'm just going to make some observations. One is, both living and dying seem to be understood as a process, not black and white. So it's difficult to know when living stops and dying starts. But when we talk about prolonging life with life support, some people think it's not that really, you're sustaining dying. You're just prolonging the dying rather than the living. It's a different way of thinking. And that's important to keep in mind. The second point I was going to make is, for a lot of people, it's not just living, it's a quality of life that matters. How much of independence you have and all that. There are people that have obviously even physical suffering, but they're able to have the capacity to live with that and still have a certain amount of joy in their lives, achievements and all that. But for lots of people that is rare. And when there's no quality of life
as they perceive it, they have to judge for themselves where it is. It's difficult for others to say, but you have everything to live for type of stuff. The third thing is this, that when one says, if somebody is not speaking, how do you know they're suffering? But I'm not too sure whether we can tell when a dog or animals are in pain. Is there ways in which one can tell, rather than being skeptical? If they can't communicate in your language, therefore there's no way of telling that they are suffering.
Hmm. There are many forms of communication. Language is one, right? We've also got visual communications, which is actually stronger. Visual communication is way stronger than what you're hearing with your ears. If somebody's doing something with the action of their body, and this, like, if they pull a gun out and they're pointing it at you and they say, I love you, as they're pulling the trigger, the visual takes more predominance than what's coming out of the mouth, because the action isn't lying, right? Pulling a trigger has a certain outcome. We're not fooled by what we're seeing in this respect as opposed to what we're hearing coming out of their mouth, right? So we're visually oriented creatures predominantly, and our learning is visual, mostly. What we listen to is about maybe 20%. The rest of it is going to come from our visual senses. It's such a strong sense. The idea of quality of life, though, is you have to be careful with the term quality of life. And what is that based on? Greed? What kind of quality is necessary? I might say quality of life for me means I have food, shelter, clothing, and medicines. For somebody else, it has to be a certain type of TV. A certain suburb. Oh, I couldn't live in that suburb. What kind of quality of life if you lived in that suburb? So this quality of life becomes kind of relative. Yeah. And we have to be careful around terms called quality of life, that our delusion or our lenses of looking at the world isn't what the quality of life for that person or that being is. How I see their quality of life should be through my eyes, not through their eyes. Maybe they're okay with it. Like you say, maybe some people can bear with certain pain. The euthanasia concept is about unbearable pain. So for that person, it has to be for that individual. What is unbearable for them, maybe it's okay for me. Maybe it's an inconvenience for me, and it's a real problem for them. But that's very individual, a very individualistic idea in terms of how you can bear or not bear with the situation. For some people, not passing their year 12 with A levels is enough for them to throw themselves off a building or a bridge. For me, I just think, what? Have a go next year, right? But for them, in that situation of their life, there doesn't seem to be any other option. They're under whatever pressures they're under. Self-created, yes, but they're under so much pressure they feel they have nowhere else to turn. So the term quality of life, I put a bit of caution behind whose quality of life are we talking about. Yep. Oh, hang on. Yep, and then yep. And then yep. If we've got time. Yes. So, Cora. Yeah.
Just a comment, really. Having just been with a person over the last couple of weeks who passed away, it was actually Anna on the screen. Anna was, as you heard, Bhante, and I heard, led a very, very vital life.
Hmm.
She was involved in so many causes. She is very successful as successful psychotherapist, very successful in her natural therapies, a very, very clever woman. And for quite a long time, she would talk about her death and plan her funeral, and she did this to a very fine degree. But what I noticed, and I think this that has bearing on quality of life, is that she was able to let go. She was able to let go of those things that had been so terribly, terribly important to her, and to get in the moment as much as possible, and peacefully in the moment, and still express qualities such as I mentioned yesterday, of gratitude to the nursing staff. You know, this is probably when she was in considerable physical pain. So those last weeks, in fact, were parts of her personal development, if you wish, the development of the ability to let go and to develop positive qualities. Mm. So I guess I'm saying we do have to be careful.
Yep.
That's all.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. Each person's experience will be different.
Yep.
And what's tolerable or not is different.
Yep.
Okay. Yep.
I'd just like to take up again the quality of life expression, because it is an expression used often in healthcare plans and end-of-life decision-making. And I think the issue is not to just say that's too hard or what I think. I think it is up to the person to outline what it is would amount to a loss of quality of life for them.
Yep.
So once again, it is the individual decision. But if you think of that woman in the Q&A, in the wheelchair, now she may still be, her brain may still be working normally and so on, but she may decide that her quality of life has become so limited or so unbearable for her that she doesn't want to go on. So I think that it's very important not to dismiss quality of life or as an expression, but I think the important thing is that the person very carefully iterates what it means to them, and that's what I've done in my end of life care plan, what quality of life means to me, because I can't do, if I can't do these things, then I don't want to be kept alive.
And to throw a little spanner in amongst the engine there, that concept of quality of life you have now could very well and truly change when you're in that hospital bed. It's dynamic. It's not a fixed, like right now I could say, I write down all this stuff and I say to my sister, this is what I want to have happen. If I'm in bed coma for 3 months or whatever, please turn the machine off. Don't feel any problem whatsoever about that. I might say that to my sister, okay? So that I don't feel that she has any burden whatsoever about flicking a switch off. Who here wants to kill a monk? Well, some of you might. maybe after this talk. So I wish to remove any burden or any guilt or feelings of, oh, should I have done the wrong thing or the right thing? I want to remove any weight from my family members in making that decision, because I write something down and I say, here you go, absolve yourself of any of that. I don't think it's nice for other people to have to think about these things, especially when it's a heightened emotional time. It's like, oh, good Lord, you just read that, okay, da 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 da. But I still, even now, I would think, what I've written down and when I'm actually in the situation, it might change. I might be able to find the courage to bear with something which I would not otherwise be able to bear with. My practice of the Dhamma might come so strong at that stage that I go, hey, what are you doing? Don't turn it off. Don't turn it off. But I can't say anything, right? So it's not a simple thing. It's a very complicated thing. And it does require quite a lot of thought. What does quality of life represent to you? I agree. It's an amorphous kind of terminology, quality of life, and it'll change for each person, and I'd even go as far as to say it could change from day to day.
Oh.
Yeah.
And it should be something that's reviewed.
Yep. Thank you. Yep.
Thank you, Anand, for bringing this topic, because I work in an aged care industry, and I see this all the time, and they talk to me, they have reached the maximum, they have done everything in their lives, and then sometimes the children take wrong decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Like for an example, 85-year-old lady had a heart attack, and then she hasn't done the advanced care plan. So we had to bring the son, and the son said to resuscitate, and after that she was a vegetable.
Mm.
So best thing, the essence we have to get here is to do your advanced care plan and write whatever you need at the end of your life to give the medical product to
you. Don't make your family make decisions that they're not really... Yeah, exactly. Only you know what you want, at least when you write it. Right? But it's better than your family playing guess, right, later on. It's at least they have an inkling of the direction of your mind, even if it's 4-year-old plan or whatever. It's better than them making it up on the spot. Yeah, trying to second guess you and feeling bad about whatever decisions they make.
And legally, now there is a document called the enduring power of attorney.
Hmm.
This is not the power of attorney for property and that.
Yep.
Enduring power of attorney, which you can give the right to anyone you trust, not necessarily a family member, with the proper instructions, and that person then has the right to tell the doctors what to do.
Mm.
Apart from what the family members might say, he can override them.
Yep. I've got one of those already, an enduring power of attorney, and I've split it between two people, a family member and a doctor who's a supporter. I've known this doctor for a long time.
I believe you can't do that.
No, you can.
Enduring medical power of only one person.
Oh, okay.
Because
not enduring. That's a power of attorney.
Your doctor and your family members don't think. This will avoid the conflict.
This was in another state that I did this. But each state, I think, has different regulations about power of attorney laws. The wording is a bit different.
It's called enduring medical power of attorney. Only one person can
have. Mm.
Otherwise, because there's a conflict.
Conflict, yes. Okay. One says yes, the other says no. Okay.
I'm curious why belief in what happens after death doesn't enter into this debate or that argument, or at what point does it? Because your belief in what happens after you die can totally frame death for you.
Yes, absolutely. And so from the Buddhist perspective, unless you're enlightened, there's another birth. And which is why I was saying before, for those who are suffering from depression or anxiety or whatever, the idea that I'm going to kill this body does not translate to finishing and making the mind peaceful. On the contrary, the process of suicide is very traumatic for a lot of people, and that trauma just continues. So you're not actually clearing the slate. You're not actually becoming enlightened by killing a body. All you're doing is taking away a form and then adopting another one later on. Okay, so I think that's all we have time for, because I've gone over time. Thank you very much for your questions.